Coming up, options trading, real estate investing, avoiding scammers, and a whole lot of shit talking. Good times.
Welcome to the Military Millionaire Podcast, where we teach service members, veterans, and their families how to build wealth through personal finance, entrepreneurship, and real estate investing. I'm your host, David Perret, and together with my co-host, Alex Felice, we're here to be your no BS guides along the most important mission you'll ever embark on, your finances.
You're clear to depart friendly lines.
Roger, Vic 1, Oscar Mike.
If you're new here, we're the best fucking military investing community in the world, and we're going to help you achieve financial freedom. So join the community, especially the free Facebook community. Grab a copy of my free book, hang out, and enjoy the ride. Now, today's guest, Eric, has spent close to 30,000 hours honing his skill set after being introduced to investing by a high school teacher turned course mentor in 2007, and he's outperformed the market for over a decade. Eric grew up poor with a single mom in a high crime area. Fun fact, he was stabbed in the hand in high school. I don't know how fun that is, but it doesn't sound very fun to me. He had not a whole lot of prospect for success, yet Eric defied the odds by adopting an outlier mindset. He continued studying and trading during his undergrad while on active duty as a Marine officer, and during his graduate degree. Tired of the bullshit and financial media, Eric's goal is to share authentic information and empower others. He is a Marine, options trader, real estate, and angel investor, first-gen millionaire, really genuine dude. Eric and I have gotten to know each other over the last couple months, and we bonded over Forex and crypto scammers and shit-talking, and he's just a great dude. So this is going to be a fun episode. Make sure you hang out. Eric, welcome to the show, brother.
What's happening, man? Good to be here.
Yeah, man, we got to know each other over the last couple months, and I'm excited about this. So normally, I told you right as we were about to hit record, normally I ask like a lead off with like a kind of a present day question, then we go back and tell, you know, paint the picture. But for this one, I just wanted to say that I love that. So for anyone listening, I have a questionnaire that goes out and Eric's response to what he's most excited about is a 605 pound deadlift PR. So I thought that was awesome. I was like, of all the guests I've had on the show, nobody's ever just filled that block with like, yeah, I deadlifted some weight. So it's a pretty significant weight.
As I was, and I mean, like, I don't wear a belt. I don't use straps. I don't wear a suit. I don't wear knee sleeves. It's all just regular lifting. It's like a moderate amount of weight. It's one of those things where like, if you compare that against like, if you compare it against a normal person, it seems like, oh, that's a lot. But then as soon as you start like talking to people who actually move weight, you realize that like you're just a little bitch and you have a long way to go. That's really what it summarizes. It depends.
Are you doing normal or are you doing sumo? I mean, if you're doing normal deadlift, that's a pretty significant. Yeah, that's a significant amount of weight.
Yeah. Notice how I said deadlift, not sumo deadlift. Yeah, there's a big difference. You got to let the sumo guys have their little thing, but conventional.
Yeah. Nope, I am not at that level anymore. I've never actually been at that level. I think I probably peaked around 500 at one point, but we'll get there again. I'm back in the mid threes, 400, so we'll see what happens.
Just double it and then you're there.
Exactly. That's it. I just gotta, I'll wake up one day. Oh, man, I got a hernia. The last thing I need to be doing is no belted. Yeah. That's how I got my hernia, probably. All right. So talk me through, kind of like your like overview, like how you got into, so you're a trader, and amongst many other things, but just kind of talk me through how you got into investing in the first place.
Dumb luck. Pure dumb luck. Yeah. That's really what it boils down to. I, like a lot of people, I grew up single mom, poor, yada, yada, yada. You know, everybody has a sob story. Mine's fine, right? Like I had a roof over my head. I had food, nothing that bad, but we didn't have a lot of money. So I remember always thinking like, man, this isn't like super awesome. Literally, if the lunch ladies at school weren't nice to me, I wouldn't have food. Literally, I wouldn't have had food because they would see that I don't have enough and they would give me extra food because they're fucking angels. But that's kind of the general circumstance. So I started saving everything I could, and I had a junior ROTC instructor introduce me to investing. Literally, that's how I got started. Because this dude saw my circumstance and made a recommendation, it sent me down that entire path.
That's awesome. I mean, you're right. Pure luck, but that's super
pure
cool.
Dumb luck.
Did he have anything to do with you joining the military, or was that something that you were planning on doing it anyway?
He led me, he actually guilt tripped me into going in as an officer because originally I was going to enlist because that's what my brother did. And I have an older brother and he went and enlisted in the Marine Corps, went down to Paris Island, same thing, right? Younger brother, you saw what your older brother did. It looked cool. You're like, fuck yeah, I'm doing that. And then I was in junior ROTC and this same instructor, I refer to him now as my stepdad. He and my mom have no relationship, but that's essentially the role that he started to fill in my life. It's the best way I can describe like who he is to me. He's a father figure. And he heard my plan and he literally was just like, yeah, he's like, I think enlisting is great. He's like, you can absolutely do that. Like, if you want to be selfish about your skill set and do that, go do that. And I was just like, you know, I'm a teenager. I'm like, wait a minute. Everybody says, thank you for service. You know, I think I'm doing the right thing. And here he is like starting to shame me. And I was like, what the fuck? And I actually started to understand his point though. And it boiled down to this. He was a retired Air Force colonel. So he had seen the world from that lens. And his punchline was that there are people that can have an impact in different ways. Some people are really good at doing the things themselves. Some people are really good at organizing people to do the things. And the way he described it, he said, as much as you like doing the things, you are the kind of person that can make a really big impact for the people doing the things. And he said, it's kind of shitty. You're going to spend a lot of time doing stuff you don't want to do, especially based on your personal disposition, but you have the skill set for it. So you need to make a choice. And boom, truth bomb. Late teens, thought I was doing some real patriotic shit. And then I just get crushed by this dude. And I'm like, I got to rethink everything, man. And I have to be honest, he was absolutely right. And it's not that everybody can make an impact where you are. I really believe that. But especially during my time with the Marines, one of the things I noticed, and this is actually one of the reasons why I rolled over to the reserves, is because being around officers and senior enlisted people that were just waiting for their 20, I couldn't stand that. Mm. It was beyond infuriating to me. And to be around that environment is caustic. And then I started to realize when I let my last unit know that I was transitioning out, everybody was surprised. They were like, I thought you were doing 20. Like, everybody thought that I was going to be a career Marine. And I always took that as a compliment. That means that all of them knew I didn't drop my fucking pack and I was going to ride that thing till the wheels fell off because that's what the Marines deserve. So to be able to give Marines that kind of presence, I think is incumbent on a leader. Not everybody wants to do that because people are fucking selfish.
That's like the worst, best pitch ever for becoming an officer. Like,
yeah,
you're not going to like it. But no. You should do it anyway because you've got the personality.
That's essentially what it boils down to, because especially most of us that are officers, you'll ask them like, what was your favorite gig? The vast majority will say platoon commander, because that's when you're the closest to the dudes and you have the ability to influence your little bubble, but you're not overwhelmed with the bureaucratic bullshit. Then from there, I went to company command, operations officer. You know, you get clicked out 250 people, then 800 people. And then you're just like, bro, like, I don't give a fuck about this stupid inspection. Like, I just want to go train the guys. And the inspection's got to happen. Totally understand. Somebody has to do that shit so that you can train. Welcome to being an officer. You get to do all the really lame shit.
Yep. And that is why I never commissioned. I thought about it a few times and I was like, nope, I enjoy what I'm doing. And, you know, I would say you can still make a difference, obviously, on the enlisted side, but it takes a lot more time to get there. Like, I probably didn't start actually making an impact until 10 or 11 years into the Corps.
Definitely. And I also think one of the most formative things for the enlisted guys, and again, you would know this, is shaping the officers. There's a reason why when we go to OCS, Officer Candidate School, it's kind of like our mini boot camp. It's nothing like what you guys go through. It's very different, obviously, but it's still all enlisted dudes that do it because we have a lot of reverence for the senior enlisted. So to your point, I actually would argue that in some ways, a senior enlisted person can make a bigger difference than an officer can. It all is context dependent. The officer will typically have the last say, but nonetheless, completely agree with you. Some of the most formative people, most of the people that I keep in touch with were my senior enlisted folks at all of my different spots. I think that tells you everything you need to know.
Yep. Hey, sir, great initiative. Let's come here. Let me tell you why we do it that way. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Keep your ass out of trouble. Keep my ass out of trouble.
Keep everybody's. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's exactly it. And, you know, the thing is when you go through your initial training as an officer, you have kind of like this idealistic of the world. You're also around all other meat eaters. Like, most officers are more aggressive, all that kind of bullshit. All that means is, like, I remember the first time that I took my platoon out for like PT, and like I had my gunny at the time come up to me and be like, "Sir, like, you gotta chill the fuck out. You're literally gonna kill everybody." And at first I'm like, "Oh, like, don't be a bitch." Like, and then you start to see what he's talking about. It's like, these guys are slaving away all day. And then, so getting that kind of perspective from him is, it shifts everything about the way you think about things. So, yeah, senior enlisted dudes, they're what it's all about. They're the people.
Yeah, good times. All right, so let's talk a little bit. So you got into trading dumb luck or pure luck or whatever you want to call it in early high school or mid high school. I guess if you want to walk me a little bit through that journey as far as like what you dabbled in at first and kind of where you fell as far as your main bread and butter, I think that'd probably be a good place to start.
Yeah, for sure. So I started in 2007. So I was in high school and I started with just buying stocks. And the way that teacher, he was advising me at the time, which is funny because he's not a big trader at all. He doesn't trade at all. He has a portfolio that he hardly manages. But the way that he got me started was saying, take a look at the things that you know, the names that you know. And that was a good start at the time. So I started buying individual stocks, things like literally like Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Paychex, and quite a few of those did really well at that time. So that's what got me super interested because I didn't start with a lot of money. It was less than $5,000. But when I started seeing that small amount of money grow, I was like, there's something to this, especially at that point in time. I was working a bunch of different jobs and some of the jobs actually paid okay for the time, but still nothing quite like that. So I have an obsessive personality naturally. I started to see promise there. So then that obsessive personality took over. I just started reading everything I could possibly find. I'd go up to the library and start reading what they had on investing and trading from there. And that's what led me into finding derivatives, options specifically. And I started trading those in, half the year through 2007. So like 6 months after I started trading, I switched over to options. And then I've stuck with that ever since.
That's awesome. I love it. And options trading, you want to give just a quick overview for anyone who, so as you know, most of what we talk about is real estate investing. And for those listening, he also has a massive real estate portfolio, which we'll get into. So he's not, completely unfamiliar with that world. It's bigger than most people's portfolio, but the options trading is interesting because we've never had anyone on the show who talks about it, mainly because most people that reach out who want to talk about it are total scammers. But, I'd love to hear a little bit, just a brief overview of what that looks like.
Yeah. And to your point on the scammers, I actually would summarize options trading as fairy dust. It's all fake. Like, it's all online fake bullshit. Realistically, options are a product. They're called derivatives. The value of an option is derived from an underlying asset. So you can have a stock in equity, which is a security like Apple. And then there are options on Apple. So it's kind of like trading a deed to a house. So you don't ever own the house outright necessarily, but if you control the rights to that house, the rights to that house still have some sort of value, kind of like that. So the reason why they're really interesting is because they provide different risk return profiles, but they also provide leverage. And if you know how to use leverage or if you learn how to use leverage, it's really efficacious for building a portfolio. Most people go about it, obviously, the way you would expect, get rich fast, overnight money, low risk returns, and all of that couldn't be further from the truth. That's actually one of the reasons why I think real estate is so cool, is because even if you have a deal that goes bad, or if you buy a property that doesn't ascend a ton in value, like, there's still an asset there. There's still something. If you trade an option and things don't go your way, all options expire at a certain point in time. So that asset, poof, gone. Fairy dust. So it's a very different way to try to grow wealth. There's a lot of benefits to it, but not all that glitters is gold. And if somebody were to get into trading, it's not something that you just pick up on the side. That's probably one of the most dangerous things you can do with trading.
Yeah, I like that. And yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, with real estate, there are not a whole lot of mistakes you can make that can't be fixed by just holding on for a long time. You know, and the bigger the mistake, the longer you get a hold. But I mean, the only properties I've ever lost, I've lost money on two, maybe three deals, and they were all deals that I was flipping. So I sold them, but if I just decided to hold them for the long term, I would have been fine.
That, and I mean, you still are able to salvage some value, right? Whereas again, if you're ignorant and you buy an option and you hold it past expiration, it's just gone. Literally, it's just gone. Not there anymore. Your money is gone. Feed the machine again.
Oh man. Well, hopefully that's not a lesson you had to learn the hard way too many times. Curious. We mentioned it briefly, and I know everyone on here has heard all the Forex and options and scammers all over the place. If you were vetting somebody right now to try to learn from them about investing in the, the equity side, what kind of things do you think you'd look out for?
When you say vetting them, what do you mean?
Well, I guess like if somebody was coming to you to say, hey, I could teach you how to do whatever, like what would be, like how would you say you'd be able to, at least within a reasonable doubt, assume that they're legit or just not at all?
Let me paint the picture for you. I did a segment with a buddy who's a Navy veteran, where we did like trading service reviews for these people that offer like alert services and shit like that. It's literally a playlist on my YouTube channel for this exact reason. And I don't remember how many we looked at. I want to say maybe like six, and zero of them, I think, were good at all, like efficacious in any capacity. One of them was a dude, I'm not going to mention his name because I don't want to give him any press, but he's a dude that says that he retired from Goldman Sachs. That's on his website. I went and he was part of our service review. So we did our standard due diligence. I mean, like we were just a couple internet dudes. So I used the thing called fucking Google and I looked up, came across a couple different things. Turns out he was at Goldman Sachs for a 6-month internship. But he says he retired from Goldman. So the point being is most of these dudes are straight fucking garbage is what it comes down to. Like if somebody is trying to sell you something, if somebody's trying to provide a service to you in general, it's probably not worth it. Like realistically, there are seldom, and there are instances where there are people that are efficacious. So like, for example, this book over here called Options as a Strategic Investment, great book by Lawrence McMillan, happily share his name. And he does different services. That dude's legit. He's absolutely legit. The only way you can really find out if somebody's legit or not is if you have somebody who is even remotely familiar with the space, take a look at them. Because it's almost like if somebody were to try and tell you that they were in the Marine Corps and then they weren't, you could kind of tell. Just a couple questions. You just know right away. Quickly. And some of it, you just got a sense. So it's the same thing with trading. But if somebody that's not in the military, and there's somebody that's not in the military, and somebody tells the person that's not in the military that they were a Marine, maybe, may or may not know.
Yeah, it'd be easy enough to fool them.
Yeah, so if the way I would summarize all of that is if for whatever reason you wanted to start picking up investing, trading, anything like that, I honestly would start with a book from a known publisher. That's the big thing. Because even on Amazon, you could put up your own shit that's not through a publisher. So it's not really vetted by anything. There's a couple names in the space that are kind of timeless. That's where I would start, just to get your feet under you. Then from there, once you have a rudimentary understanding, you can start talking to people to see maybe if you want to service an accelerator, that's okay. But a couple giant red flags is if somebody has really good returns, right? Just like Bernie Madoff, if it sounds too good to be true, probably is. The other thing is if somebody has no drawdowns in their history, or if they have no losing years, also call bullshit on that.
Yeah.
The third thing is if they're not willing to share or provide some sort of audited returns. If I was providing some sort of alert service, I owe you that. I don't do an alert service. I don't want people to cling on to me like a fucking leech to learn how to make money. The whole platform I have is to try to give you tools for you to go do it for yourself, because I don't want to worry about you. I have a hard enough time worrying about me. But yeah, it's a slimy space, unfortunately, that's really overrun with just slick marketing.
Yeah, I love that. And I love that you mentioned the audit, because I've always joked with people, like when I get pitched by that, I'm like, cool, can I see your like tax returns or just the back end of your trading account? And, you know, they always disappear immediately. Actually, it's funny you mentioned the guy who like totally illegitimate or whatever, or the internship. I just saw a post on, must've been Instagram. And it was one of those where it's like someone made a post on Twitter and then people were commenting and they screenshot like the comment thread. And so it was this dude who, I guess he's a trader, quote unquote. And he took one of those super, everybody knows it picture where it's like leaned up against his green Lamborghini backed in the driveway, not in the garage, but in the driveway of a, you know, really nice house in Florida. And it's like, you know, some bogus, like 3 years, I went from zero to 70 million, you know, whatever the quote, the caption was. And below that, the first comment that had all the likes was like, this house is not owned by, and it tagged him. And then it had the Zillow listing and said, it's listed for rent right now. And I was like, man.
The really cool part about that is people are getting smart. Like, people are starting to see those kinds of things and they're seeing it for the red flag that it is. You actually bring up one other really good point, is just trading tenure. So if you think about the time it takes to build mastery in anything, it's not going to happen within 5 years. Even if you're doing it all the time, 5 years still isn't long enough. So that's just another really simple question you could ask people. How long have you been doing this? And if somebody said anything less than 10 years, I don't give a flying fuck about you. I might listen to what you have to say. You might have something interesting. I'm willing to hear people out, but there's a 0% chance I'm doing anything with what you're providing me. You literally have not been on the earth doing this thing long enough.
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. You know, the other thing I found interesting when you spoke to our group the other day, you were talking about the whatever it is, the publisher that like the top 20 traders in the nation every year, and they actually vet everything. And you made a really interesting point to me, and that was, you know, some of these guys are at like 800% returns for the year vetted, but you never see the same guy on the list twice.
Super rare. There's probably maybe three or four names I can think of that came in the top three more than once.
Because anyway, we can go on and on and on and on. Okay, so here's a question for you. Is it more important to, and I love asymmetric bets, so is it more important to have a crazy high return on a deal or to avoid losing?
From a human nature standpoint, we innately view the two differently. Even if it was you can gain a dollar or lose a dollar, from a behavioral standpoint, we view losing a dollar as more severe than gaining the dollar. So I think, obviously, with everything, it really does depend. I don't try to squeeze out of questions like that. I just like to answer them accurately. So it depends on like the circumstance. Yeah. But the way that I view it is you can outperform a lot of benchmarks focusing on either of those. You can either have a very low hit rate with a relatively managed loss, but if every once in a while you knock it out of the park, you're going to do well. Or you could have the inverse scenario where you have a couple big losing positions, but you have tons of small winning positions. So really the way I think about that is my North Star is positive expected return. That's what I care about. So that just takes the win probability, the win size, less or divided by loss probability, loss size. That gives me the North Star. Does this thing make sense for me? Yes or no?
Yeah. Yeah. Good. I like it. All right. So in the pre-interview questionnaire, you said that your superpower is thinking differently, which intrigued me. So I'm curious, you know, how do you think differently and in what ways does that benefit you?
Yeah. So I think the way that I think differently than most people is that I don't give a fuck what everybody else is doing. I do not care. What I care about is defining what I consider to be an agreeable benchmark. And then that is what I'm pursuing. I don't give a fuck if I'm doing better than Ted over there. If Ted isn't doing shit, why would that matter to me? I don't care. What I fully care about is whatever my top line benchmark is and how can I get to that. Prime example, Marine Corps PFT, Marine Corps CFT. There's a min score, max score. I, for the longest time, didn't even know what the minimum was. I couldn't possibly care less what the minimum was. I was worried about maxing this. That's it. So I think I gain no solace from comparing myself to a quote unquote peer group. And if I'm better or worse than them, even at TBS, at all of the kind of the standard Marine Corps schools, I was always in the top 10 or 5%. And that's not because I'm like this super great superhuman. I took no solace in saying like, oh yeah, okay, I'm better than 50% of the people. That's good enough for me. I don't even care about the other people. What I care about is what is this person at the top doing? How do I get there? How do I get close to that? That's what I care about. So I think that's what my superpower is not caring what other people are doing and having my own high benchmarks.
Yeah, I think that's a great piece of feedback. I was the same way. I don't think I ever ran anything other than a first class, you know, PFT, CFT. And when you start doing training op stuff, you're like, what do you mean that's passing? How is that a thing? But it is what it is. All right. So I've heard you mention outliers or the outlier mindset a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Big Malcolm Gladwell fan. I kind of assume that might be where that came from. So I don't know if that's accurate, but I'm curious if that's something you picked up from the Commandant's reading list. Okay. Well, then maybe not. So where'd you pick up the outlier mindset?
So in my undergrad and subsequently my grad degree, I'm very stats heavy. So the idea of positive negative skew was always interesting to me. But specifically, when you look at the distribution of humans doing things, the vast majority of that distribution lies within kind of this centralized zone. We would call it plus and minus one standard deviation. And again, average doesn't concern me. I've always been interested with these people that are performing way out here outside of where everybody else is. And my primary interest is figuring out how to get as close to that as possible. So really the concept of outliers for me just stemmed from looking at statistics, realizing that average kind of sucks. How do I not do that?
I like it. Yeah. Outliers is a fun concept. Like it's kind of crazy. It doesn't take a whole lot to be like out the normal these days. It feels like it's like it doesn't take a whole lot of just consistency to beat the norm.
You also bring up a good point where there are different ways to achieve outlier performance. So one of the ways you can do it is kind of what we've already talked about before, which is having large positive asymmetric returns. Another way that you can do it is realistically just not having big drawdowns, but having enough winning positions. That's how I've outperformed the market now for over a decade and a half. It's not because I'm crushing the market to the upside every single year, but I've learned that if I just figure out a way that when the market is going down, that I just step out of the way and don't realize as much of a drawdown, and I don't have that lower basis to then try to compound from, you can actually beat the market not that crazily by avoiding drawdowns. So there's kind of like playing the game on easy mode in some instances. Now I say that tongue in cheek, really not easy, but definitely easier than trying to outperform the benchmark every single year.
Yeah, no, I get it. When did you start moving towards real estate investing, angel investing, and what kind of prompted that?
Angel investing happened before real estate. Interesting. And if you hear that dinging, it's just a couple of trades going off my back. Market is open.
Making money.
I actually just lost money on an SPX position, but you know, we're re-entering, we're running it back. But I think what got me into angel investing was opportunity. What I've learned time and time again is that luck is part of the equation. You have to be lucky to some degree, But if you're not prepared when luck shows up, then luck isn't there. Point being is, in college, at that point, I had already been trading for a while. I had started flipping motorcycles. I started with a buddy buying cars, fixing them, and selling them to save that money. What ended up happening was, is I had working capital at a time when most people didn't. So then I actually had a family friend reach out. He was a prior Marine gunny that was doing like an entertainment business over in Dubai, and he was looking for investors. So I was like, yeah, sure, I do this. So then I worked out a deal with him, and that was kind of my first angel and first step into angel investing was something like that. So that started because of being at a place where I could take advantage of an opportunity when it emerged. That then spread into real estate. Really started with my first house when I got stationed out in California. Did the same thing everybody does. VA loan, got into the first house. I still put some money down. I put like 10% down just to lower the mortgage. But overall, that provided good leverage. And then from there, I acquired a rental property in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, with a friend. He ended up buying me out of that deal. I kind of dabbled with residential. And then from there, I transitioned over to commercial real estate primarily. That's happened in definitely the later part of my investing career. And it's because it takes a certain amount of capital to even be invited to that table. Yep. So it took a little while because, ergo, back to the beginning, didn't have a lot of money growing up. So it took your boy a minute to scrape together all the coins to, you know, bring it to the people.
I feel that. Yeah. No, same thing, same upbringing. Well, maybe not same upbringing, but same super well-off financial start where if I hadn't totaled my Harley and gotten an insurance payout, I wouldn't have been able to pay the 3.5% down for my first property.
I love that. That's honestly light years better than mine. That's so funny.
I wasn't even on it. I was sitting at a bar and some dude parked on top of it, and he'd been drinking and he owned a car dealership. And he was like, I can't afford for this to go on my insurance. Can I cut you a check? I'm like, yes. And then I was like, oh, I can buy a house now.
Dude, that makes yours even better still. The fact that you weren't even on it, just some fucking drunk dude ran your shit over.
Yep. But you notice I had the Harley, which means I went on, you know, deployed and did all the typical dumb shit young enlisted guys do. So
yes, you did.
Yeah. I had my 20 grand and then it was gone. Truck, guns, motorcycle, tattoos, women. Lasted a month. It's great.
It sounded like when my brother, he got back from an Iraq deployment, and when I was in college and I went out to visit him, and he was staying with a buddy because he had just gotten back. And when I went to stay with them, he had sent them so many car parts for his Camaro that I was sleeping on the floor because there was nowhere else for me to sleep. I literally made a fort out of car parts that he had bought while he was deployed. So yeah.
And this kind of stuff is why my whole platform exists now. It's like, man, I wish somebody had told me. I might not have listened all the way, but if I listened a little bit, I'd be all right.
You know? Just some of the way. Yeah, you'd be better off.
Or, you know, you'll appreciate this because you do the whole stock thing, right? I thought I was great. I put 10% in my TSP, anywhere from 8 to 12%, depending for like the first 7 years I was in. And if just one person had come along and said, hey, how about you move it into a different fund than the G fund, I would have been in a great spot. But from 2008 to 2015, you know, some of the best years the market's had in a minute, my money was earning 1 to 2% instead of the 20 to 30% it could have.
Yeah, so that's super unfortunate, especially like with the TSP. I'm glad that they've already adjusted it and like they're kind of growing it to go in a different route, because there's a lot of issues that frustrated me with it, but
yeah,
it sounds like you got a pretty raw into that deal. So, you know,
we learned lessons learned. Yeah. I still got six figures in there, so it's whatever, but, it could be higher six figures. So it is what it is. But I mean, you're right. It goes into life cycle fund now, which is, at least if you don't know what you're doing, that's still better than leaving to the G fund. So, you know, it's not the best thing you could do with it, but it's better than nothing, I guess. So
yeah, I mean, for me, what I did with mine is I just rolled it. I rolled it out into an IRA, something I can trade. But even if you can't trade it, you can always just set it up how you want, like a buy and hold structure. That's probably what I would do personally if I hadn't done that already.
Yeah. So I know trading in a lot of realms takes a massive amount of time, right? That's one of the reasons when people tell me they're going to get into day trading, I'm like, dude, even if you do outperform me by 5%, like, is it worth the amount of time it takes? But I know you aren't necessarily in the game 24/7. And I know we've talked index funds. Like, are you thinking at some point you're going to, you know, chill out on the trading and go more passively, or is it like a hobby for you? Like, how much time do you spend at, like, realistically sitting and trading right now?
The, like, sitting and trading in terms of like clicking a button depends on the day. As per usual, it can be anything from 0 minutes to several hours.
Yeah,
it really depends. The fact of the matter is I view it as the way that I've structured my trading is so that most of it can be executed without me having to babysit. And then when I see interesting opportunities, I'll apply more time and effort to those. So what, like, one of the things is, and I haven't talked about this much, I'm not ready to talk about it because I'm still looking for a reoccurrence of the scenario that I came across. But last year, suffice it to say that over the course of 2 days, I've made a tremendous amount of money relative to me. And it was in the market. And it's because I had come across this thing that I had passively been looking for, happened to see it, knew what I saw, positioned to take advantage of it. And then over the course of 2 days, it was, again, massive return. Now, if you amortize out the time, the subsequent time that led into that return, I actually still think it's a pretty good return. But it's not something that is super common. So it's not like my bread and butter. I'm not hoping that that's how I'm going to make my, you know, my nut this year. But I do think that trading is one of the coolest ways to learn about the world. That's what I love about it, is I get to learn about all these different companies, all these different technologies, all these different relationships between different commodities, products, different country relationships. I get to learn about the production cycle of commodities like corn, wheat. I love that. It's so cool. And one of the neatest parts about all of that is it's all painted in the finance lens, which is not left-leaning, not right-leaning. It's literally, does this make money? How does it make money? That's what we care about. That part is very cool to me.
Yeah, I think that's awesome. That's a great way to look at it. And no, I appreciate your answer. I know a lot of people, you know, some people, it's a full-time job, and that I'm kind of like, man, that doesn't sound appealing to me, even if you do crush it, because I like the freedom to pick up and move. But I also know that you have found a way to balance that. I appreciate that you haven't, you know, thrown out your one return last year that was incredible and been like, oh, buy my course for my super secretive, look at all this money I made on this one trade. You can too for only $10. But anyway.
No, but what I actually try to tell people with stuff like trading is that it's way more about the sustainability of whatever it is. If you can develop an approach that's relatively sustainable, it can make decent money over the long run. And there you go. You can amplify your returns without an inordinate amount of effort. I'm definitely beyond the mark of diminishing returns. And a lot of that is because of just general interest. But I think with some very basic muscle movements, you can position a portfolio, even from a buy and hold perspective, to do much better than just a standard benchmark. And it doesn't take much effort whatsoever. It's just a matter of thinking what's working now. So, like, for example, if somebody had a portfolio with the S&P 500 SPY index ETF, and then sometime over the last decade plus, you said, tech is doing pretty well. Maybe I'll put 20% of my money into tech. Then in addition to SPY, you have 20% of your money in QQQ, which is the NASDAQ 100 tech ETF. You've just grossly outperformed the SPY over the last decade. So it doesn't have to be this like intricate thesis for everything. Some of it really can be that straightforward. Now, to be clear, obviously, hindsight pretty damn clear, right? We know what happened. But again, as a betting man, which I am, if I'm to forecast out over the next 10 years, do I think tech in general is going to be worth more or less than it is now? In case you didn't know, Elon Musk just put a chip in a motherfucker's brain. I think it's going to be worth more in 10 years.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. And I think that's a simple, super simple way to look through it and, you know, and to look at it. And that's why I love it. I'm an index funds guy whenever I'm in, you know, the market, but that's just because I know I don't have the attention to detail or desire to do all the work required to actually trade and not just guess. And so, you know, I'm pretty set on index funds, but, I think that's a really smart way to look at it because you're right. Yeah. If you think tech is going to do well, then just bet on that industry at a higher percentage and average out your portfolio.
Done.
It's like, you know, crypto. I'm not a huge crypto guy. I read a lot because I was trying to learn. You know, I think the blockchain technology has some pretty cool applications for the future, potentially with, like, fingers crossed, they'll redesign the title companies for real estate because they suck and there's no reason for them to be so painful. But you know, I was talking to somebody and they're like, oh, it's so risky. You can't afford to have it in your portfolio. And I'm like, well, I'm an asymmetric bets guy. If it's 1-5% of my portfolio, I'm not really risking that much of a hit. But if it goes, if it pops, I mean, it can pull most of your portfolio up a decent amount. So I don't know.
Definitely. And the other thing is, depending on your timeline, time is also a smoother of returns. So Bitcoin or whatever other blockchain technology vector you're using now could seem, you know, like it's haywire right now, but it doesn't have to be. And if you look at it over a 30-year period, it might not look that crazy. So yeah, it's, I think the way you're looking at that is smart, to be completely honest. And I think people in general, and I don't know if it's just like my peer group, I'm 32, so I don't know if it's my age, younger than me, whatever it is, but I feel like people are too damn risk averse. Like, that's honestly what I think, just too damn risk averse. And if you allow yourself to get too comfortable with not taking any risk, it becomes even more difficult to take any risk. So then all of a sudden there's a lot of opportunities just slinging by. Like this recent opportunity that I was telling you about with the commercial real estate, there was an exposure opportunity to a ski resort. And that it was a big chunk of my money that I put into this ski resort. They told me right out of the gate, I had friends with the operators and we were talking about the business deal, how it was going to be structured, what the future of the deal was, all that kind of shit. And I was looking, I was like, huh, this is not going to be liquid for the foreseeable future. And the dude was my friend. He was just like, yeah, or ever. And so if you look at that kind of risk and you're like, if I'm going to put in a bunch of money into something that might not ever be liquid, are you okay with that risk? And you got to be willing to take a fucking shot. Like, if you're not willing to take a shot, you shouldn't be surprised when you look around and you have nothing to show for it because you haven't taken a shot.
I agree. And that's one of my, when people ask me what makes, like, set service members apart for investing, one of my favorite things to talk about, other than, and I've got my typical answer, but I love the fact that, like, if you're in the military, you're basically guaranteed, like, you're not going to get laid off. You're good for that 4 years, as long as you don't get a DUI or, like, something ridiculous. Like, you know, it's on you if you don't make it to the end of that 4 years. Which provides a really, really safe benchmark for you to go and take some risks because you're still going to have a place to live, a meal to eat, and, you know, all your needs covered, even if you take a massive loss, which, you know, not to say you can't live that way in, like, the corporate world, but there's always the risk of a layoff. You don't really have to worry about that in the military. So it's like, in my opinion, it's like the most secure way to take some risks at an early age when, you know, the compounding effect means that if those risks hit early, you know, you're good. And if not, you're 25 years old and you can start over, like, okay, that's the same as if you were graduating college and starting for the first time, except you have experience.
And the interesting thing there is you highlight again the human psyche where we're more scared to lose than we are to gain, even exactly to your point where you're at a point in your life where you can reasonably lose, gain that experience, and then be smarter going forward. It's not even like a total loss of an experience. Yes, you lost money, not great, but if you learn along that process, as lame as that sounds, like that's still a valuable transaction. So to be too risk averse where the fear of loss is overwhelming to the point where you don't take any risks, then it's very difficult to make any progress in anything. Like if you think about anybody who's doing something admirable, big, noteworthy, there was a fucking risk involved somewhere.
Absolutely. Yeah. You don't build Tesla and SpaceX without risking something. You don't build Apple without, I mean, everybody. Yeah, absolutely.
And even if you look at something like SpaceX, it was fascinating where I was watching a documentary about that. And Elon Musk was saying that if they had just a couple more rocket failures, and I don't think it was a couple. I literally think it was one or two at the point. They literally were going to be bankrupt. They were going to have to close the doors.
Dude, Elon is like my favorite person in the world because of the things he's like. He is. He's, for one, he's hilarious. Like all the things he's hidden in his vehicles, or like the fact that his line spells out sexy cars, or like all the, you know, the volume goes up to 11, like Spinal Tap, like all the funny stuff. But the dude, like PayPal rolled into Tesla, you know, somewhere along there. Like my favorite story of him is he had a McLaren F1 and he was riding with a PayPal exec to a meeting and he was like, what does this thing do? And he's like, oh, I'll show you. So he totals the car, which is like a $1 million car, gets out of it and he's laughing. And the other dude's like, you know, what's so funny? Like, you know, we just totaled this $1 million car at like 100-something miles an hour. And, you know, Elon's like, oh, you don't know the half of it. I didn't even insure it. Like calls an Uber or whatever and goes to his meeting and just leaves it on the side of the road. Like, but yeah, he rolled all his money into Tesla. Then he rolled all his money into SpaceX. And he was from the book I read. Like, yeah, it was like, if this rocket or the next one doesn't work, there's literally like, I don't even know who to go to anymore.
People like him, like quite literally, there's very few men in my life that I put up on a pedestal. I view most men as men, qualities that I admire, but I don't put him up on a pedestal. He is one of those exceptions to me, because anytime that I'm feeling sorry for myself, where I'm like, damn, like, what am I doing? What's my purpose? Like all this, you know, sad boy shit. And then you look at somebody like him who literally could have retired 35 years ago with millions and millions of dollars. And he's still working the way he does. It's like that man has found a purpose, even though he has more resources than most of us could ever even fathom. And he's still out there getting it. If he can do that, I can do it. And I just need to stop being a little bitch about it.
Yeah, and he lives in like a boxable, like fold out house on like his launch pad in Texas. He's in that job. Oh man! All right, so let's see. I got four questions that I ask everybody on the show. So the first one is
talk dirty to me. No,
that's for after the show. Name a trait you think set service members up for success after the military.
Accountability. That's the one that comes to mind. Every service member, no matter what branch you're from, is taught accountability to some degree. And it's something that a lot of people lack. And anything that I can think of where people are creating significant success for themselves stems from kind of a branch over to stoicism, locus of control. What can you control? Service members are taught that from the get-go. So hands down, I would say accountability.
That's a really good answer. And I actually don't think anyone's ever used that one before. So that's good.
Oh, hell yeah. Go me.
Yeah. You're special. What's the dumbest thing you've ever purchased?
I don't want to stay quiet for too long. Nothing is like springing up to me.
That's good.
So, there's something there. That's not that there isn't anything, but I literally can't think of anything that I've bought that was like, what would qualify that for me is if it was really expensive and I didn't like it, or, you know, want to throw it out. I've bought in a lot of like cheap little things. Like, for example, there was I like knives. So I bought this interesting looking knife that was kind of different than what I've seen before. And it was like this carbon fiber. I literally have it in that drawer behind me. It's cool, too expensive for what it was. Well, maybe that. It's stupid, but I really don't have a lot of those things. I'm so frugal with what I spend on if I'm buying it, it's something I like this mammoth tusk right there.
Yeah.
Not cheap. Absolutely love it. That, like, most of the stuff that I have like that, I actually really, really like.
I can respect that. I think that's a good answer. I think it, you know, if it, who cares, you know, cause people are, I always say that, and people always say like a car, and I'm like, well, I'm going to buy a, you know, 100, you know, 6-figure Porsche this year. That's the goal. And
I was going to say,
it's not going to be a bad idea. Like, it is something I've put off for 7-8 years while building my real estate portfolio. And it is.
Yeah, dude. You know? Like, I have a Raptor, a C7, and a McLaren. I like all my cars. Like,
what kind of McLaren?
Yeah. It's a 570S.
Nice. I rented I rented an orange 570 the day I EAS to pick up my DD214.
That's the color of mine.
I had way too much fun with that thing for a day. Yeah. I made like 5 videos where I was like, buy my course and you can rent this car too. And then I'd like, you know, it was just stupid shit making fun of Guru.
It's so fun.
But I drove it to IPAC, and I'll never forget like walking at IPAC with my DD214 and I like, you know, I lifting up the door and one of the majors from like one of my previous commands is walking past. It was just like, I'm like, everything in me wants to tell him it's rented, but I'm like, enjoy the core. Like,
yep. Dude, we had a kid that was in the barracks that had a Lamborghini because his parents were super rich and that was the car he wanted. So literally he would show up to hikes with his pack in the front passenger seat of his fucking Lamborghini. Oh, I loved it so much.
That's amazing. Oh my God. All right. Do you have a smartest purchase in mind?
Smartest purchase hopefully will be this fucking ski resort, fingers crossed. But beyond that, which might, I think that probably will be it. I think it's a little too early to tell, but so far I would wager that it is.
Yeah. I mean, if it's anything like some of the, I've tried to like pencil math some of the numbers while I'm out here and I'm like, dude, these things, they crush. You know, $8 for a black coffee without the Irish part. I'm like, what the hell? Okay. Name a book or a podcast resource, you know, that has either made you into a better, investor or leader that you recommend to people.
Oh, you threw a curveball at the end with investor or leader. I thought I was just going to be able to name anything.
Oh, I mean, if you want to like name 50 Shades of Grey or some fictional book, that's cool. No, probably not beneficial to people.
I'm going to do two things then. Based on the question that I wanted you to say that you pulled out from underneath me at the last second is Huberman Lab podcast. Love that dude.
Yeah.
And then the answer to your lame question that would have been better the other way is that book, Options as a Strategic Investment for me. Now, if you're not an options trader, though, I think The Intelligent Investor. Now, one note on The Intelligent Investor is it is a grind to read. It is boring, slow, verbose, but really good information. If you want to trade with any frequency, you should absolutely read that book.
Yeah, there's a reason Warren's been pimping that book out for like 80 years. I mean, it's good book. Yeah, but it is. You are not kidding. I do audiobooks. And I was like, this is not a book to listen to at 2x. I got to slow this shit down if I'm going to take any of this in.
I don't even know how you could listen to that book. Like, I'm actually curious who they had narrate that book, because there's no way to make that shit sound interesting. Defensive stocks or
Yeah, it was painful. It was very painful. It was one of those books I got done with. It was like, let me go download the SparkNotes summary and revamp just to try to make sure
So I have one question for you. What's the book or podcast that you would recommend for investing?
Oh, you see where I struggle. Well,
podcast. How do you like that question?
my struggle with that is that it depends on where people are in their journey. But right now I would say, Ben Hardy and Dan Sullivan, 10x is easier than 2x is the book that I read this year that probably made the most impact. That's where I was in my business. It's basically about like outsourcing shit to focus on your zone of genius, which is, you know, something I've heard a million times, but they do a good job of breaking down like tactically, like, hey, you should do this and here's how you should figure out what to get rid of and then do this. And I'm like, you know, I think I've hired, I brought 4 people onto the team this year after reading that book. So, you know, full-time video editor, full-time copywriter, train my assistant to schedule all my content. So literally I just record and upload and then I'm done. And then I hired a podcast editing team, a new one that was more efficient. and a community manager. So I'm trying to focus on the things that matter.
Yeah. See, that's a good answer.
And my podcast, because I'm a, you know, pushover. No, I'm just kidding. But
gotta plug it somewhere.
Yeah. Hey, if you like the show, please leave a review on Google. I'm actually the worst at asking for that. So, all right. So here's one for you. Somebody who's listening to the show, right? The tendency for people seems to be like, oh, this is cool. I'm going to listen to another podcast episode. If they actually want to make, you know, an impact on their bottom line, what is an action they should take other than just flip into the next episode of the show?
Your question confused the shit out of me. I'll be honest with you.
Perfect. All right. Okay. So what would be the next step you'd point someone towards if they wanted to learn about stocks without just clicking onto another podcast?
Oh, about stocks. I see. Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
I think the most efficient way to two choices. The first one would be to go to ChatGPT, literally, whether it's the free or paid version, and essentially prompt it. Say, I know nothing about stocks or the stock market. Teach me the fundamentals and read that. That's what I would do at this point. The second thing I would do is go onto a website called Investopedia. And that would be the next pick for me. And it's because the reason why is with the finance space, you have to be so careful with what the incentive structure is for places. Like, for example, if you have a broker and you go to your broker for education, without going too far into detail, long story short, they're incentivized to make you to trade more because it makes them make more money. That's the punchline. So yeah, you have to kind of understand that painting as they're giving you information. It's not pure objective information. They have a motive somewhere. Investopedia literally doesn't. The motive is to have you on their website, which you are reading. That's perfect. So to me, there's probably a better alignment of incentives there. Yeah, those would be the two things.
I think it's a really, really well put answer. I love the ChatGPT answer. I think that's a great use for it. And then you're right, man. The word financial advisor just makes me cringe these days. I'm like, if you don't have a CFP or a Series 7, Series 6, like something, like, don't even bug me in my community. But the main reason for that is,
I was going to say, even if you have people that have those licenses, like, look at their performance. It literally doesn't matter. It's just more schooling. I've been to doctors before that I would never say I know more than somebody went to school to be a doctor, but I've gotten bad medical advice from somebody that's a doctor. So the point being is, like, there's still got to be that sanity, you know, behind whatever they're talking about.
Yeah. And I really like fee only advisors over, like, the assets under management guys, because they're incentivized for you to come back, and you're going to come back if you're winning. They're not incentivized by, ooh, how much money does this guy have in the account that I can take a percentage of? And how much am I going to get paid for pimping out this product? And so, yeah, I'm a fan of, you know, I think alignment is something that people undervalue sometimes.
Yeah, it skews everything that they're sharing with you.
Where can people get a hold of you?
At ES Invest on YouTube or esinvest.com is website. Either of those is cool.
Beautiful. Easy. Eric, anything we missed we need to touch on?
Well, I thought you were going to talk dirty to me, but I guess we're just going to...
After the recording.
I know, but I'm impatient. So it would be really nice if you were to deliver on that.
I do actually have a question for you after the recording I wrote down.
Yeah. Well, cool. No, I overall obviously love chatting with you, man. It's a blast. So thanks for having me. Thanks for doing what you do. I think when I look at the finance space in general, whether it's investing in the stock market, real estate, I genuinely do not think that there are that many authentic voices, like, genuinely. And I'm always looking for them because people like you are the people I love to work with. I love the content itself, but I like the community and working with people even more. So doing stuff like this is very cool for me, but seeing people like you doing something that I consider to be genuinely value add to people is fucking awesome. So thank you for doing what you do.
I appreciate you, man. It means a lot.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us, and let's go talk dirty.
Hasta luego.